Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be tackling something that's really at the heart of securities law.
Definitely.
And that is insider trading. And specifically, we're going to dig into something called the misappropriation theory.
Right.
Now, this is going to be a really fascinating area for, well, I think anybody who's interested in finance and obviously, you know, the law. But especially for those of you who are navigating the complexities of, you know, Wall Street or the legal frameworks that kind of govern our markets, this is a really important area to get a grasp on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And to kind of get a better understanding of this whole misappropriation theory, we're going to be taking a close look at a super important case, a case that came out of the Second Circuit called United States versus Newman.
Ah, yes, Newman.
It was decided back in 1981. And, you know, for those of you out there who are studying law, this is, you know, kind of a must-know case.
Yeah, you got to know Newman.
Exactly. And what's really interesting about it is how this decision actually ended up expanding the scope of who could be held liable for insider trading.
Under Rule 10b-5.
Yes, under Rule 10b-5.
That's super important rule against securities fraud.
Exactly.
So Newman, this case, it really wrestles with a really, really important question. And a question that I'm sure a lot of you are probably thinking about as we even just mentioned this topic. Mm-hmm. And that's the question of what happens. What happens when someone trades on information that is confidential, like real inside information,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't get it straight from a company insider?
Right.
Right. So they're not, you know, the CEO's brother-in-law or, you know, something like that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It really changed the whole way we think about insider trading.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is, you know, in this deep dive, we're going to break down the facts of the case, you know, kind of the nitty gritty details of what happened. And then the big legal issues that the court was dealing with. What the Second Circuit decided, and, you know, probably most importantly, why this case, even though it's decades old, it still matters today.
Right.
I mean, why does this case still shape our understanding of securities law?
Absolutely. Well, to start off, you know, to really understand Newman, you got to kind of take a step back and look at, you know, what was going on. So the case really centers on this guy, James Mitchell Newman. He was a trader. And between 1973 and 1978, he was allegedly getting confidential information, you know, stuff about upcoming mergers and acquisitions, the kind of information that can really move markets.
Right. The kind of information that you can make a lot of money off of if you know it before everyone else.
Yeah, exactly. But here's the thing. This information wasn't coming directly from the companies that were involved. It was coming from employees. Specifically employees at these two very big, very prominent Wall Street investment banks, Morgan Stanley and Kuhn Loeb.
Okay, so you're talking about leaks from inside these banks.
Exactly, leaks.
Okay, so let me paint a picture for everyone. So we've got these people, these individuals inside these powerful investment banks, and they know stuff. They know what's going to happen. They know about these mergers.
Right.
And they're supposed to keep that information secret.
Yeah, they have a professional obligation, you know, fiduciary duty to keep it quiet to their employers and to their clients.
Right. And you're saying they're not doing that?
No, they're allegedly passing it along, leaking it.
And Newman is the one who's getting it.
Yes. And allegedly using it to get an edge in the stock market.
Classic insider trading.
Well, the indictment really goes into detail about how Newman and other people involved were allegedly using, get this, foreign bank accounts to trade on this confidential information. And it wasn't just for himself.
Right.
The allegation is that he was sharing profits with those employees at Morgan Stanley and Kuhn Loeb, the ones who were giving him the tips.
So a real network.
Exactly.
Okay, so this is clearly a scenario where you've got this information that's not available to the average investor,
mm-hmm.
and someone's allegedly profiting off of it. So what happened? What were the legal consequences for Newman? What did they throw at him?
So they actually went after him on a couple of different fronts.
Okay.
They charged him with securities fraud, which falls under, you know, Section 10B of the Securities Exchange Act and Rule 10b-5, which I'm sure you law students are all familiar with.
Yeah, bread and butter stuff there.
Yeah, actually. But then, and this is interesting, they also charged him with mail fraud.
Mail fraud?
Yes, mail fraud. And conspiracy to commit both securities fraud and mail fraud.
Okay, now mail fraud. I think some people might be raising their eyebrows at this, so we're definitely going to come back to why that was included.
Absolutely.
But first, I'm curious, like, when this case first went to court, what happened?
So this is interesting. The U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, they actually dismissed every single count of the indictment against Newman.
Wow. Girly.
Yeah, it was a pretty big deal. And they basically said that, you know, the securities laws that existed at the time, they didn't really clearly prohibit this specific type of behavior, this whole thing of trading on information that was obtained improperly from an employer, but an employer that wasn't actually involved in the, you know, the buying or selling of the securities itself.
Right.
So they were like, well, you know, the law doesn't really say you can't do this.
Wow. So that sounds like a pretty big win for Newman, at least at that stage.
Yeah. It seems like he was off the hook.
But we know that wasn't the end of the story, right?
No, it wasn't the end of the story. The government, they weren't satisfied.
Of course not.
So they appealed that dismissal and they took it up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals.
Okay.
Which I'm sure for those of you studying law, you know, the Second Circuit, that's a big deal.
Yeah, huge.
Especially when it comes to securities law in the U.S. I mean, they really set a lot of precedents.
Yeah.
And the Second Circuit, well, they overturned the district court's decision.
They did. Wow.
Yeah. They reinstated the indictment against Newman.
Okay. So the Second Circuit was not on the same page as that lower court. Not at all.
Yeah.
So what were the big legal questions, the ones that they were really grappling with when they took on this appeal?
So there were, I'd say there were two really big ones, like at the heart of this whole thing.
Okay.
First, they had to decide whether the indictment, you know, the one against Newman, whether it actually laid out a crime, whether it actually alleged a criminal violation of the securities laws, specifically under this idea of the misappropriation theory, right? Could somebody be found guilty of securities fraud because they traded on information that was stolen from their employer, even if that employer wasn't the one buying or selling the stocks involved?
Right, right, because that is different, right? Because we often think of insider trading, and I think people use the term classical theory, where you've got an insider at a company, and they know something about their own company, and they use that information. But here we're talking about information coming from a completely different source. These investment banks.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, it's a really important distinction to make. And the second big question they were looking at was, you know, did Newman actually know? Did he have enough warning, what lawyers call fair notice, that what he was doing was actually illegal?
Right, right. Because, you know, you can't really say, you know, go after somebody for doing something if it wasn't clear that it was against the law.
Exactly. So that was a big question, too.
Okay, so how did the Second Circuit rule? What did they say about these questions?
Well, they sided with the government.
Okay.
They said, yes, trading on this misappropriated confidential information, that can be a violation of Rule 10b-5.
Okay.
Even if the source of the information, the investment banks, weren't directly involved in buying or selling the stocks.
Right.
And they also rejected that argument that Newman didn't have fair notice. They said, no, no, no. There were enough legal precedents out there. You know, there were other cases. He should have known.
Okay, so this misappropriation theory, I think this is really important to kind of unpack a little bit. For those of you who are maybe, you know, just starting to get into this area of law or are just, you know, interested in it, can you break it down? What are the elements of the misappropriation theory as the Second Circuit laid them out in Newman?
Sure. So at its heart, the misappropriation theory has a few key parts.
Okay.
First, there has to be a misappropriation,
right,
which is basically, you know, a theft, a wrongful taking of confidential information. The second part is that that misappropriation has to be done by somebody who's in a position of trust or confidence with the source of that information. So think of it as like a breach of that professional obligation.
Right, that fiduciary duty.
Exactly.
To the entity that owns the information.
You're right. And then third, the person who misappropriated it or somebody they shared it with, they call that a tippy.
Right.
They have to then trade on that information.
Okay, so in the Newman case, you had the employees at the investment banks.
Right.
They had this duty to their employers, to their clients, to keep that information quiet. And they violated that duty.
Exactly.
By allegedly leaking it to Newman. And then Newman, by trading on that information, became liable.
Yeah, that's the gist of it.
Okay, so it all comes down to that breach of duty.
Right. And what's really interesting here is that the court really distinguished this situation from that more traditional insider trading that the Supreme Court had looked at in Chiarella v. United States.
Oh, right, Chiarella.
Just a year earlier in 1980. And in Chiarella, the Supreme Court, they were really focused on the duty that a corporate insider owes to the shareholders of their own company,
right,
when they're trading on that non-public information.
Okay, so that's your classic insider trading.
Exactly. But with Newman, the Second Circuit, they were saying, no, the liability here, it comes from breaching a duty to the banks and their clients.
Because they're the source of the information.
Right.
Yeah.
Not to the shareholders of the companies that Newman was actually trading in.
Right. That's a really important distinction. So it's not just about, you know, being sneaky and deceiving the people you're trading with in the market.
Right.
It's about deceiving the source of the information, the people you had that duty to.
Exactly. And the Second Circuit even used some really strong language.
I'll bet they did.
To really hit this point home. They said that the defendants wronged the bank's clients by artificially inflating stock prices through their trades.
Wow.
So they were really making a point. And they also said that this confidential information, it's a form of property and it's protected. And they even tied that in with the mail fraud statutes, which Newman was also charged with.
Right. So they were saying this is like stealing. You're stealing information.
Exactly.
And then using that information to make money in the stock market.
Yeah.
So what about Newman's defense that he didn't know, that he didn't realize this was against the law?
Yeah, he was saying, I had no idea, but the Second Circuit wasn't buying it. They said, no. You know, there were other cases. There were precedents like SEC versus Texas Gulf Sulphur back in the 60s, which already established a pretty broad rule against, you know, trading based on unfair advantages.
Right.
So the court felt that those past rulings, they were enough warning. That you can't just trade on this kind of confidential information without getting into trouble.
Right. It sounds like they were really firm on that. Was there any disagreement among the judges, or were they pretty much all in agreement on this?
So there actually was a partial dissent from Judge Dumbold.
Okay.
He did agree with the majority's decision to reverse the lower court.
Okay.
But he did have some concerns about using Section 10B in the specific case.
Okay.
He was worried that the scope of securities fraud under that section, it should really be about protecting the people who are actually participating in the market, the buyers and the sellers.
Right.
And he wasn't entirely convinced that this misappropriation theory, it fit perfectly within that traditional framework.
So he was more on the side of like securities fraud should involve some kind of direct harm to someone on the other side of the trade.
Exactly. But even Judge Dumbold, he did agree with the majority on the mail fraud charges. He said, look, this scheme that Newman was using with the foreign bank accounts and getting trade confirmations through the mail, it clearly involved interstate commerce.
Yeah.
It involved the postal service.
Right.
And this is a really important point for those of you in law school. It shows how even things that seem pretty routine in business, like using the mail, can actually establish federal jurisdiction in a financial crime case.
Right. That mail fraud, that's the hook.
Exactly.
So even if there was some debate about the securities fraud, using the mail in the scheme gave them another way to go after him.
Exactly. Mail fraud is often used as this kind of backup charge in these cases because it's sometimes easier to prove that the jurisdictional requirements have been met. So if you use the mail as part of your fraudulent activities, even indirectly, you could face federal mail fraud charges.
Wow. So looking back at United States versus Newman, what are the big lessons here? Why is this case still so important for understanding securities law today?
I think the most significant impact of Newman is that it really solidified and expanded the scope of liability for insider trading.
Beyond just classic insider trading.
Exactly. It went beyond corporate insiders trading in their own company's stock.
Yeah.
And it established the misappropriation theory, which was later explicitly endorsed by the Supreme Court in United States versus O'Hagan in 1997.
Right. O'Hagan, another big one.
So what this means for you future lawyers and finance folks is that you have to understand you can be liable for insider trading even if you're not directly breaking a fiduciary duty to the company whose stock you're trading.
As long as you obtained confidential information improperly and traded on it.
Exactly. So it's not just about betraying your own shareholders. It's about betraying whoever gave you that confidential information in the first place.
That's huge. So for anyone in law school, this case really shows how important it is to understand fiduciary duties when we talk about securities law.
Absolutely.
The duty might not always be directly to the shareholders. It can be to your employer, your clients, anyone who trusts you with that confidential information.
Right.
And it shows how prosecutors can use other laws, like mail fraud, mm-hmm. along with securities fraud, to really make their case strong.
Exactly.
It really paints a clear picture of how serious the legal system takes.
Yeah.
This whole issue of using non-public information in the markets.
Yeah, no kidding.
So let's throw out a hypothetical here just to, you know, really solidify this for everyone listening. So let's say in the Newman case, you know, what if he had just stumbled across that information? Like he didn't, you know, there was no breach of duty. Like what if he overheard a conversation like in public?
Yeah.
Would that change things under the Newman ruling?
Ooh, that's a good question. So under the misappropriation theory, as it was laid out in Newman, the key thing is that breach of fiduciary duty, or some similar relationship of trust and confidence. If Newman had just overheard something and there was no breach, then Newman probably wouldn't apply. There would be no misappropriation.
Okay, so it all comes back to that duty.
Right. But it's worth noting that there might be other legal theories about unlawful trading that could still come into play.
Right.
But it wouldn't be the same as Newman.
Okay. So really the big takeaway from Newman is that securities fraud under Rule 10b-5, it's not just about directly deceiving the people you're buying from or selling to. It's also about deceiving the source of that information, violating that trust. And that's where the emphasis is.
Absolutely. And like we saw in the Newman case, even things that seem routine, like using foreign bank accounts or getting those trade confirmations through the mail, it can all be really important when it's part of a bigger scheme to use confidential information improperly.
It shows how different areas of law can really overlap when you're dealing with financial crimes.
Definitely.
So we focused today on this idea of deceiving the source of information rather than just harming people in the market.
Right.
And it makes me wonder, you know, in today's world, with all the digital information flying around, how does this principle of misappropriation, of breach of duty, how does it apply to the new ways we're seeing information shared and traded?
That is the million-dollar question. It's something that everyone's thinking about, legal scholars, regulators, and, you know, future lawyers like yourselves. The basic principles from Newman, you know, deception, breaching that duty to the source, they probably still apply.
Right.
But how they apply to these new technologies and all the new ways we communicate, that's something that's still evolving.
That's going to be interesting to see how it all unfolds.
It is.
Well, this has been a really great deep dive into United States versus Newman. Next time, maybe we can look at Dirks versus SEC, another big Supreme Court case.
Yeah, Dirks.
That one built on Newman and looked at the liability of tippies, the people who receive those tips.
Definitely a good one.
Thanks for joining us today for the deep dive.
Of course.
We'll see you next time.